my friend, Dr. Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute, Mises, MISES.org. They're over there in Auburn, Alabama. You've been watching the March Madness, Mark?
I've been watching a little bit of it, yeah. It's always exciting times, and it's always great to be with you on a wonderful Monday morning.
Well, I mean, it's always good to be with you as well. Now, are you like a lot of us SEC folks, we're pulling for an all-SEC championship game?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way I operate is basically that if Auburn's not in it, then I'm going to be pulling for an SEC team, A, because, you know, I'm more familiar with them, and B, just because, you know, if Auburn's going to win something, we want to win it over the most substantial, reputable opponents.
Yeah,
if that happens to be Alabama.
Well, you know, a lot of people don't understand the way the SEC mentality works. But generally, I'd say the vast majority, probably over 90% of us, will pull for our other conference members.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think it's especially true if it's not your rival. I mean, I've heard, you know, that Alabama fans would never pull for Auburn, and I've even heard it once or twice where Auburn fans would never pull for Alabama. But certainly we're going to pull for Vanderbilt if it's in some kind of championship hut in Tennessee and Georgia and maybe Florida. And so, you know, it's a conference. It's not a military thing where we're out to kill one another. This is a competitive, friendly, competitive. You know, if sports go beyond that, then I see a problem with sports. And so if you can't be, you know, gentlemanly about something like this, then you just need to leave, basically, is the way I feel about it.
Yeah, don't go poison trees.
Yeah, exactly. Poisoning trees and causing confrontations, physical confrontations after games. I mean, there's just no place for that. And, you know, the Auburn-Alabama game got so contentious that for a number of years they stopped playing the game. And it only came back many years later. And so it just goes to show you that there's a limit as to how far you can take the competitive nature, especially of amateur athletics.
Speaking of poison trees, what we're talking about is Auburn, where Mark is located, has a famous area called Toomer's Corner, and had some beautiful specimen oaks, and an Alabama fan, and not affiliated with the University of Alabama, and he just some stupid fan went and poisoned the trees. The trees eventually died. They're replacing those trees, aren't they?
That's right. They just released plans just in the last couple of days, actually. And so you can go on the internet and see the diagram that they've staked out. And they're really going to try to keep it to its original nature, and they're going to restore some of the masonry work. But they're also going to upgrade the whole site as well and enlarge it and make it look like it was actually originally designed to be a special place on campus instead of what simply became a special place on campus, the original entrance to the campus. And so it's going to be blocked off, and they're going to begin construction fairly soon, or reconstruction fairly soon.
Well, you know, those big 200-year-old oaks don't generally survive being moved. Are they going to be planting just some, you know, 8-inch caliper? I mean, what are they planning on doing about the size of the trees they're going to replace them with?
Well, there's a couple of things in the works, and one of them is that they've taken seedlings from the original trees many years ago and have been growing these trees at the university, and people have actually purchased saplings and are growing the offspring of these trees all around the world, actually, wherever that those kind of trees can grow. And so the university has that option, as well as simply bringing in some fairly substantial size, similar versions of the same variety. You know, they can bring in, I think it is, they have a new device that can go and, dig up the entire root ball of a tree that's maybe 15 feet high. So there's a couple of options that they have at their disposal, to get those trees up and running. And I think they're actually using both methods for the primary two trees. And then there's going to be secondary trees behind them.
Were those white oaks, red oaks? What kind of oak trees were they?
They were live oaks.
Live oaks.
Yeah.
Okay.
They were live oaks, and there's actually, those trees were in on the campus for over 100 years, I believe, or close to it.
Well, talking about 100 years, we were talking last week, and we ran out of time, about the history of our central banks. We had the Bank of North America, the first bank of the United States, the second bank of the United States. Just a rundown on the Bank of North America and the first bank of the United States, and then we can dig into the second bank of the U.S. How's that sound?
Sounds fine.
Okay. You want to just give us a synopsis on the first two?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a whole history of central banking in the U.S., and there's basically been four different experiments. The Bank of North America was essentially a central bank that was at the disposal, I should say, of during the Revolutionary War to the Continental Congress under the Articles of Confederation. And of course, there was, you know, they provided the inflation and the buying up government debt in order to try to finance that war. The first bank of the U.S. emerges with the establishment of the U.S. Constitution. And, you know, the reconfiguration of the government into what was intended to be the modern form. And Alexander Hamilton, the Federalists, the merchant class basically advocated for, what essentially is a central bank, but it also had this public-private partnership type of a phenomenon, which is something we're going to see in all four cases, that there's a public nature to it, with public power and public purpose, but there's also a private part with private investors and private interests involved, which is really at the base of it, the source of the corrupting factor that also, when you combine that with the actual nature of a central bank, you get very bad results that we talk about on a weekly basis. And of course, the first bank in the United States, went through its inflationary expansionary phase, and was ultimately brought to an end in when its charter ran out in 1811. And you know, when we've already covered the basic the problems that existed of monetary expansion booming in the economy, and then monetary contraction, and then a collapsing, liquidating economy in terms of things like crop prices and land prices and real estate speculation and so forth. So that first bank in the United States ends right before the War of 1812, which is where we get back on the central bank bandwagon with the establishment of the second bank of the U.S. After the War of 1812. And so, you know, there's this sort of constant rhythm in American history that basically is covered up in high school and college American history classes, that, you know, those classes tend to talk about, you know, we go to war, we win the war, and then we do other great things. And, you know, the truth is you go to war, you can't afford to pay for it, so you have to hide the cost on the American people, so you create a central bank, which then prints up the money in order to pay for all the battling and carnage and equipment and so forth. And then there's a collapse afterwards, which shouldn't be very surprising once you sort of are exposed to the nature of this whole process of war and central banking and national debt and then subsequent economic collapse. So in the wake of the War of 1812, you know, there was an expansion in order to fight the war. And as a result, you know, banks could not redeem their banknotes. And this is an era where banks, on the basis of the deposits they have in their banks, they can issue banknotes, which then can be used to make purchases in the economy or just simply to carry around your money. But eventually the idea is you return those banknotes to the bank, either you or the merchant that you bought goods from, and they return these banknotes and get gold and silver specie coin. Well, you know, in the wake of the War of 1812, there was a suspension of specie payment, basically, in the U.S., and, you know, banks would simply just not agree to redeem their banknotes under those conditions, because there was too many banknotes out relative to the amount of specie that they had on hand.
Okay.
You know, that sort of situation where the government is allowing banks to not redeem specie. In other words, these banks should have been closed and gone through a liquidation or a bankruptcy process. But given that the government wasn't, you know, requiring redemption of specie, well, that meant banks could, you know, print up even more banknotes and more people could go into banking. And so once the cat was out of the bag, the number of banks started increasing at a fairly rapid rate. I mean, I think there was something like 230 banks in the entire U.S. in 1816. And then under this lack of specie redemption or gold redemption, 2 years later, there were 340 banks. And so that's a massive increase. And the money supply during that same period, and it's hard to imagine this, but the money supply during that period, and it consisted of nothing more than paper banknotes, increased by 40%. And so naturally, with the increase in the money supply of something like that, you know, the economy began to boom in the sense that prices began to increase. And so you had real estate prices and land prices and farm prices, the price for slaves, you know, the prices for stocks. As a matter of fact, this is the first time that there was a stock mania in the United States. Traditionally, stocks were sold in financial districts on the street corner, but stock dealing became such a big thing in the 18 teens that they actually had to open a stock exchange building on Wall Street. And so you get the feel here that this lack of redemption of gold for banknotes created this massive monetary inflation, and then that caused a boom in prices. And, you know, there was two things that they could have done at this point, is to either continue, you know, on with this inflationary boom, or to try to bring it to a bust, to try to bring it to an end. And that's essentially what they did. They decided to take control back from the system. The Second Bank of the U.S. started to begin, you know, contractionary policy moves in terms of curtailing loans and credit, refusing to provide a uniform national currency in the sense that the Bank of the U.S. would no longer redeem the banknotes of very shaky banks without a discount attached to it. And they also actually began purchasing more gold from abroad. And so they brought that inflationary boom. They finally got the reins around it. They saw the writing on the wall that it couldn't go on. And in effect, what happened after the War of 1812 is we had our first modern business cycle in the U.S., where a central bank had really engineered a true monetary and credit expansion, and then was forced on the basis of, you know, this incredible speculation and malinvestment in the economy to bring that to an end. And, of course, you get a massive reduction in the money supply starting in 1818. And, of course, this is going to lead to the panic of 1819. But the money supply from mid-1818 to mid-1819 fell by 50%. And so these are massive, massive changes in the economy. There was a massive liquidation of capital and capital goods. You know, there was a lot of defaulting, a lot of bankruptcies. But the interesting thing is liquidation, and what that really means is it's really financial liquidation. You know, the pieces of paper that are attached to houses, businesses, farms, slaves, you know, whatever the capital structure in the economy, it's not the actual liquidation of the homes. The homes are not destroyed. The factories are not destroyed. The businesses are not destroyed. The farms are not destroyed. It's the pieces of paper that are attached to it. And so, you know, back then when they allowed the money supply to fall and they allowed prices to fall, they allowed bankruptcies and foreclosures and in general what's called liquidation, you know, that doesn't have to be a terrible macroeconomic event. It doesn't have to be, you know, something that's taking place over a long period of time. It can be very quick, and the economy can get right back at it. Now, of course, there are terrible consequences to this, and there are lessons to be learned. And I think the lessons to be learned from this episode of the First Bank of the U.S., and this first business cycle, which was the panic of 1819, and let me say that Murray Rothbard's dissertation was published in on the exact topic of the panic of 1819, and you can get a copy of it really cheap at Mises.org, and I think people would enjoy that. But the lesson here, I think, was the lesson that was learned by the Jacksonians, basically. And, you know, they learned to hate inflation, much like the American Revolutionary leaders hated inflation, much like the Germans who experienced the hyperinflation in Germany, how they hated inflation. And so we did learn a lesson, at least temporarily, from that. And so I think that's a great thing, that the economy recovered fairly substantially, quickly, and that we learned this lesson about what to do and not to do about in terms of monetary policy.
Mark, has there ever been a central bank for the entirety of its history that did not destroy its currency?
Well, that's a good question. You know, well, there certainly are, you know, existing central banks that have not yet destroyed their currency, but historically speaking, there's not a lot of good evidence for that. Amsterdam, the Bank of Amsterdam, was a solid, solidly put together governmental bank back in the 17th century, but it eventually was undone by bad policies. The Suffolk Bank system in England, I think it was the 1830s, was a private sector central bank, but it was undermined by the political process. And so there's been examples of short-term, you know, centralizing institutions that have worked really well, but nothing that has persisted, over the long run, that hasn't eventually, where the government hasn't come in and, you know, undermined that success. And I think that's, you know, the key thing is that we have to come up with monetary institutions where the government has no prerogative, of manipulating money, manipulating banking, manipulating credit, of, you know, suspending specie redemptions. The government has screwed up the monetary system pretty much over and over again throughout history, and so we've learned a lot of lessons, and we have a great idea of how monetary institutions should function in a free society, but we've yet to experience that on a long run basis.
Mark, I have in my possession a few 1935 $1 silver certificates, uncirculated. I got them when the Continental Bank of Chicago failed several years ago, I guess almost 20 years ago now. We're getting older. clearly it states on there that I can take these to a bank and present them, and they're supposed to give me my silver dollar. Just as clearly, if I attempted to do that, the only thing I could redeem them for is probably four quarters. How does the government, I mean, these are in my possession. They weren't like FDR, but people weren't made felons if they didn't present them. But this is basically a promissory note. There was an obligation here to give me this silver, and yet no silver. How does the government get away doing stuff like that?
Well, that's exactly like these suspension of specie redemption problems that we experienced throughout the 19th century in the United States, where state governments or the national government would give banks the privilege of suspending specie redemption. And so, you know, that's a problem, because the banking class is historically well connected with the political class, and essentially they're an overlapping class where the political class is connected to both the banking and industrial big business type classes. And so we've got to come up with something to prevent that kind of thing. And that's why, you know, when Austrians, a lot of Austrians think in terms of where gold and silver are physically in the possession of people, where money is the physical gold and silver, and where banks are not allowed to use our deposits as the basis, you know, demand deposits as the basis of loans. So you put a firewall between the monetary system and the banking system, and that it should be illegal, and that any attempt by the banks to or the government to supersede that right of redemption in gold and silver coin, that the system would immediately put economic pressure you know, on the government's ability to interfere with the monetary system and the banking system.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this is just a broken promise here. I mean, it clearly says I can redeem it.
Yeah, that's the deal. And the moral hazard here is that banks will get into business not of just issuing banknotes on the basis of the money that you've deposited in the bank, but issuing a multitude of banknotes on the amount of money in terms of gold and silver that's deposited in the bank, so that they're, you know, they're multiplying the money supply through a fractional reserve banking system, and then they get the political class to come in and bail them out once the problems of that process are revealed. Once, you know, prices start rising, people want to get more of their money out of the bank, and oops, all of a sudden the bank runs out of reserves and can no longer redeem their banknotes for gold and silver coins. And at that point, they want the government to come in and bail them out. Now, that whole process of expanding and then running into problems and seeking a bailout is something that is just as true at the beginning of this nation and these other banks in the U.S. as it is today, with the way the Federal Reserve is essentially bailing out the big banks in the system by keeping them with reserve, the ability to get more reserves at a 0% interest rate. So they're not preventing us from taking our money out of the bank, but they're just giving banks an unlimited line of credit to make those redemptions at a 0% interest rate. So it's basically the same thing. It's just taking a different form, but the banks are getting, and in particular, the big banks are getting the big bailout, which ultimately is going to come at a cost to the rest of us.
Well, this thing says clearly, silver certificate, this certifies that there is on deposit in the Treasury of the United States of America $1 in silver payable to the bearer on demand. But if I went up there and demanded my silver, they just look at me. Now, I would also like to point out, I know there was a chain email going around that Knowing God We Trust on some coins that are supposedly coming out. This 1935G was the last $1 that did not bear that. So we've had plenty of currency that did not bear In God We Trust. We're speaking with Dr. Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute. Welcome to the final segment of today's show. We're in the middle of a conversation with Dr. Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute, MISES.org. We've been talking about the history of our three central banks. Mark, I thought it was interesting to note that we had that period after Jackson famously killed the second bank of the U.S. We went, about 70 years with no central bank?
Yes. The Jackson and the Jacksonians killed off the second bank of the U.S. despite a lot of opposition. I mean, the Federalists and a lot of interests wanted the second bank charter to be, rechartered. It was given 20 years, and Jackson was there to ultimately crush it and to prevent the rechartering. And basically, they were, the Jacksonians, on the basis of experience from the debacles of the War of 1812 and the Panic of 1819, they wanted to kill that as a central bank. And they also did some great things. I mean, they greatly reduced tariffs in the United States, and that was the major form of taxation at the national level was a heavy protective tariff. And, so the rates were, in the neighborhood of close to 50%, and then the Jacksonians got a hold of it. I think they brought the average tariff rate down below 20%. And so everything that was imported into the economy face a tax of nearly 50%, and they brought that down to 20%, and they eliminated the national debt at the same time. And so this is sort of the second round of the good guys. Jefferson, when he was elected president, he eliminated almost all of the various forms of federal taxation, and he got rid of the national debt. And then, Jackson and the Jacksonians come in, and they did something pretty much along the same lines. They reduced the federal tariff, and they eliminated the national debt, and the economy really boomed from the Panic of 1837 throughout the next two decades. In the economy, the U.S. experienced its highest rate of economic growth. If you measure real GDP on a per capita basis, which means you take out price fluctuations and you measure prosperity on a per person basis, the rate of growth in our prosperity during those two decades was higher by my calculations and by calculations of other people as the highest in American history. And, the banking sector was as free as it could be. We had a what's called free banking during that period, but you still had to get a government charter, and in order to issue banknotes, you had to hold reserves that were made on the basis of state bonds. And so it was not a perfect system, but it was the best system that we've had. And then, of course, you have the American Civil War and the National Banking Acts of 1862 and 1863, which put the American banking system on a regulated, pyramided banking system, which lasts until the passage of the Federal Reserve in 1913. And, of course, we had a lot of panics during that period, but a period of definite prosperity, but we had these periodic panics because of the pyramided nature of the money and banking system from 1865 to 1912.
I think it's always interesting to note, and you don't hear much about it in our history books, but Congress attempted to impeach Jackson after he closed the Second Bank of the U.S.
Yes, I'd actually forgotten that. the political battles at the time were enormous, and it was all about really economic issues. And the two most important issues were international trade in the form of the tariff and whether or not we were going to have a central bank, whether we were or not. And Jackson and the Jacksonians came down really hard in a libertarian fashion. They wanted to essentially eliminate the federal government, eliminate the national debt, and eliminate the central banks. Well, that plays very well in the South, the Mid-Atlantic, some of the Midwestern states. But once you get up into England and you get into those more commercial areas and the in Pennsylvania and in Massachusetts, which had industry that was competing with Europe, I mean, these people wanted the government on their side. They wanted, you know, government contracts. They wanted protective tariffs. And they wanted cheap money provided by the central banks. And so that whole area of the country, you know, where the power elite sort of are resident from, those people were vehemently opposed. There was nothing good that they saw in the Democratic Party. And in particular, Jackson, who sort of flaunted what his beliefs and very often made fun of his opposition.
Okay, so can we talk about how we went through a very prosperous period without the central bank for that period of free banking, and then lo and behold, we get the fourth and probably the worst of our four central banks, the Federal Reserve System. How did that come to be?
Well, I think that's a very good point, is that, you know, if you look at the United States, you're starting with a colony that's almost disconnected from the rest of the world. And just a little over 100 years later, it becomes the world's economic superpower. And this is on the basis of mostly during that time period, you have limited government involvement in banks, particularly from 1837 to 1914, this background National Banking Act regulation was a passive system that wasn't subject to political manipulation that much. But it was one where you did have booms and busts and panics. But the trend line through there is a period of tremendous economic growth, interspersed with these government experiments in central banking and regulation. But you do get to the point with, you know, a gold and silver monetary system, a relatively unregulated banking system or sporadically regulated banking system. You get from this colonial outpost to world economic superpower. And as you get towards the end of that period, you got to remember that this passive regulation system that the federal government had was now experiencing the gold rush from, you know, places like Alaska and Australia, the Yukon Territory. And so the species content of the monetary system was, you know, growing significantly towards the end of this period. And then that gets pyramided on with additional banknotes and lending. And so there was this period of monetary euphoria at the end. But then as the new gold supply started tapering off, the economy went into the panic of 1907, basically, where they saw that, you know, this source of new funds was starting to dry up. And, you know, the panic of 1907 was really something that got the attention of bankers in general. And so there was always this infighting between the big city banks of New York and then later Chicago and St. Louis and the lesser country banks, which didn't have any influence or really special privileges under the National Banking Act. So there was this division between the different types of banks. But the panic of 1907 sort of brought bankers together and you know, that they realized they needed that go back to that old system of a central bank. And so everybody got caught up in this push for a new central bank in the United States, which ultimately led to the passage of the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. And it had been supported by the National Monetary Commission, which had been a propaganda sort of outlet to make a push for exactly this type of central bank.
We're going to need to leave it right there. This is Dr. Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute.